I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, I'm Sarit.
I'm Itamar. Together we are Honey & Co.
Listeners who have been with us since we started podcasting will know that we began with live talks in our London deli, Honey & Spice.
It was a way for us to meet the writers, reviewers, chefs and producers, all the people we really admire in the food world.
But 9 series in, our podcast is so much more than that. We've done a series with the Victoria and Albert Museum. We've done one about International Women's Day. We've grilled our way around the Levant. So do check out our back catalogue.
Of course, we were so happy to be awarded Podcast of the Year by Fordham & Mason. We got a hamper that's big enough to live in. And now we're kicking off the new season with our favorite thing, which is sitting down for a good long chat with some of the most interesting chefs and writers from both sides of the Atlantic about books, life, and food.
And in the future, we're really going to dig deep. We're going to bring you insights into the food world through interviews and cook-alongs and diaries and lots of adventures. We really hope you join us.
And in that spirit, welcome to Honey & Co, the Food Sessions.
Today, we have the most exciting young chef with us. Jake is a New Yorker. He started in culinary school, went to work for some Michelin-starred restaurants in New York, and then moved into food media, writing, reviewing, and recipe testing.
His first book, Jew-ish, Reinvented Recipes for a Modern Mensch, is a New York Times bestseller and one of the books we most enjoyed during lockdown. An incredible first book, and we cannot wait to see what he's going to come up with next.
He's already built a mighty following on social media. There are legions of people out there plaiting their challah loaves because they've watched Jake on Instagram and on TikTok. He's a truly fascinating writer, and I know you'll enjoy him as much as we did. Welcome to Jake Cohen.
Hi. Such a pleasure to be here.
It's such a pleasure for us. We have been your biggest Instagram fans.
Yes. Even though we're a bit too old to be.
No, there's no age. There's no age for any of us.
All we want to do is come with our Zimmer frame to one of your Shabbat dinners and just kind of croak in the corner and look at the kids making challah and enjoying it. But Jack, let's start at the beginning. So you're from a Jewish background, obviously, which kind of necessarily means
food
would be a big deal. This is our thing, isn't it? Food and guilt. This is what we do.
Food and guilt. Yes.
In that order.
In that order, and always one with the other, never separate.
Yeah, it's the best seasoning.
I grew up here in New York, and I truly had that very Seinfeld-esque upbringing. It was always about food. It was always about family and when we were eating, what we were eating. Did you make enough food? Who gets to take home leftovers? All of it. And so much of it surrounded the high holidays. We were a relatively secular family, but that being said, some of my fondest and earliest memories around food, around family, were at Passover, at Rosh Hashanah, at breakfast. And I think that really just solidified this love for food, but also this understanding of hospitality, its power to build community, to show love, and just be so much more than nourishment.
To sort of bring people together.
But how you end up in the food world? Because let's say that's not usually a Jewish mother's aspiration for her kids, is for them to end up in the world of food. They want them to eat, but not to work in it.
There you go. 100%. Yes. For me, it was in high school. I was someone that I was of the generation Food Network at its prime. I'd come home from school every day. I would turn it on. I would watch Giada and Ina Garten and Rachel Ray and And I started throwing these little dinner parties for friends, and they weren't very good. Obviously, I was just like this child, but it was the first time where I really got a taste of hospitality, of cooking for others, of that power and the love and attention and admiration that you receive in response. And it was very powerful. And I knew pretty much from then, it was like, this is what I want to do. And I had my mind set on it. I applied to the Culinary Institute of America. It was the only college I applied to, no backup. It was just like, this is what's going to happen. And I've always someone that's, I have these fantasies, and if it doesn't fit with my fantasy, that's not going to work for me. What they really like hammer into you in culinary school is go and work for the best restaurant you could work at. Do the best thing, the hardest thing, challenge yourself. And for me, that was going to a 3 Michelin star restaurant in New York. So that's what I did. And I went to Danielle, and it was an incredible experience, something that I would never do again because it's just not me. It's not my vibe. So from there, I went to ABC Kitchen, which is obviously like a very hot restaurant in New York under Jean Georges that farmed a table, and we were getting everything from the Green Market, and it was fresh and everyone loved it. It was so hard to get a table. And even like switching up the type of restaurant just didn't do it for me. And I kind of came to the realization, like, I don't want to own a restaurant. I don't want to run a restaurant. God bless both of you for doing such an incredible job with it. But for me, I just knew that there was passion around food separate from the restaurant world. And I made the switch to media, and I started from the bottom as an intern, and then worked my way up onto the masthead at Sever, and then went to digital, and then went to, I was the food critic for Time Out New York for a while, reviewing restaurants, and then focused more on social. So I jumped around, and throughout that whole time was focusing on building my own platform and social media followings, in which I could continue to leverage that for sharing recipes, sharing ideas, inspiring people in the kitchen. And I think once I did that enough to a degree where it wasn't just me speaking to a void, but having a dialogue with a large community, people start to pay attention, which is nice.
But it seems to me like, you know, and I'm glad about it that you have found your voice, you have found your clan, and it is not a small clan, it's not niche. I mean, your book Jewish came out 2021, so kind of like the eve of the pandemic. It found a huge crowd. It had big resonance, New York Times bestsellers list.
Yeah.
That's a little cherry on top. It's quite a crowd, and I think you did manage to reach a lot of kitchens and a lot of hearts, definitely our hearts, with your kind of unique take on things. And your source material was not easy. You know, you didn't shy away from hardcore Ashkenazi food, which is, you know, not.
But is it?
But isn't
it? That's what I'm looking. No, that's what I'm looking to change. That is this conversation that we're having right now, is I spent so long listening to what the food world determined was good, what was determined was hip. And I mean, you two are perfect examples, like what you've done with Honey and Co. And like, I remember, like, we went to, after my husband and I got engaged, we did this crazy 3-week trip through Europe that was all like based on reservations we made. And we obviously went to Honey and Co. for brunch. But the idea that in London, this food capital in Europe, in which really the only foods that were celebrated are European foods, French food, Italian food. You look at America, of what is designated as a fancy restaurant, what is designated as something that people would want to make at home. How many non-Italian people own an Italian cookbook? But how many non-Jewish people own a Jewish cookbook? I think a lot of it is not actually based on the food itself, but it's based on the way that we as a society deem what is good and what isn't. So yes, a lot of Jewish food is rooted in poverty and needs a little updating. But once you update it, this is delicious. If you love mushrooms, if you love cabbage, if you love fermented foods, if you love long braised stews, if you love hearty grains and beans, like, great. There's a lot of Spanish food that really all it is it's like the same vibe as Ashkenazi food with a little smoked paprika in it. Like that's really like there's so many parallels and similarities. So I just want to change people's mindsets. I would say a perfect example is kasher varnishkas. Old school Ashkenazi, typically I get it at a deli. It's super gray and not that nice. And it's bow tie pasta with buckwheat groats, fried onions, sometimes with mushrooms. And I was like, all right, we're not going to put this in a little deli cup. Instead, we're going to treat this like this is your pasta night. And we're making like a nice kasha varnish because you're going to cook down lots of fancy mushrooms, caramelize onions. We're going to treat this well, finish it with lemon and chopped dill. It's going to be bright and hearty and earthy and everything that you didn't think you knew about Jewish food. So guess what? Tuesday night, we're making Jewish food for dinner.
Yeah.
So the accolades, like this book making the New York Times list, like no one expected that. My publisher definitely didn't. I did because, again, like I said, I have these fantasies and that was part of the fantasy. Mm. But for me, it's not about me. This book is, it's a very like common thing in the Jewish world, at least in America. Something is categorized as either good for the Jews or bad for the Jews. And that could be a person, a place, a thing, an event, an idea, a company. And I've always just wanted to do something that was good for the Jews, which is because once I started cooking it, it started unraveling all of these aspects of my identity that I just eventually realized that like everything in my life, whether big or small, is touched by Judaism, touched by a Jewish upbringing, touched by my connection to hospitality and food through the Jewish lens. And I can't separate myself from that. And I don't want to or need to. But it's a relatively new thing.
But Jake, how do you then take that to a publisher and say to them, hey, this is what I'm going to do? Because no one is really celebrating their Judaism there. And still you have managed to publish a book. And this is by no means a small feat. And to come to publishers, and like you say, you don't have a restaurant specifically, then it's easier to explain the route. But how do you go about actually having this good idea, developing an identity and getting it done?
I'll tell you, it was something that I leveraged my social media following, my connections in the industry of who I'd been contributing to publication-wise. And I was given a chance by a publisher, wasn't given a big advance. It was very much treated as it was a second tier project. Like it was something that was going to be great. Another Jewish book from this kid. It'll probably be fine because he's got enough followers that a couple of people will buy it and great.
His aunties.
He'll stay like that.
His aunties.
He'll stay like that. It wasn't until I was able to prove that no. The world is going to pay attention to Jewish food. We are going to be celebrating this. We are going to be putting this on the Today Show, on Rachel Ray, in these magazines. Like, this is going to be something that we are going to pause and really give some thought towards, that I now can go back to them. And my next Jewish book will be treated like any other primetime cookbook on the market. And that's part of just the world is changing. And I had to hustle to make sure that this first one did really well so that it wouldn't be that the next time around, it's like, no, actually, you saw what happened. No one wanted the Jewish book. Let's do Instant Pot or I don't know, some other fad thing that people love to crank out a cookbook for. That was never enough for me. My book had to have voice. It had to be an extension of myself. It had to be fun and campy, and it couldn't be too serious. That could only happen if I was just being myself on paper, and that had to be through a Jewish lens. It's like even in conversations about future books or projects and going more general, like what does a general Jake Cohen cookbook look like? Even if it's not like in your face Jewish, its undertones are always going to be Jewish in the same way that Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's not like, it's not Schissel, but it's still inherently Jewish because that's who he is.
Don't you think the food on Shtizel looks pretty bad though? You know, when they're eating on Shtizel, it doesn't look, you know.
Doesn't make your mouth water.
Yeah, we are all about the celebration. I think there's enough incredible Ashkenazi food happening in Israel in the same way there's incredible Mizrahi food and Sephardic food, New York especially, whether that's Hungarian Jewish food, Latvian Jewish food, Russian Jewish food. We're seeing so much more of that from young Ashkenazi chefs that are leaning into that aspect of their heritage. When I think about everything that I want to do in terms of this platform that I've built, it's lifting up other voices. It's the baseline of everything I want to do going forward to make it easier for the next generation.
It sounds like, when you say it now, it sounds like a very articulate mission statement to kind of like revitalize and shine this beautiful light on Ashkenazi food, which is really getting, was getting for a long time, quite bad rep.
Usually from you, Itamar. Like, I'm just going to point it out as like...
But that's fine. There's a lot of internalized...
I married like this, you know, this guy over there, and he thinks, oh, I'm Yemeni Egyptian. I eat the best food. And he automatically, this is everything. What, Itamar?
No, because I think, you know, a lot of people, I think especially in Israel, have the same, you know, because I'm kind of mixed heritage, half Ashkenazi, half Sephardi. And then like, you know, the holidays that you do with the Ashkenazi side, you're like, why? And then the holiday with the Mizrahi side, it's like, yay!
It's different. And this is something that happened and will, I mean, in my household, my husband is Persian Iraqi Jewish. And our...
Was it an option for you to marry outside the faith?
The faith of Ashkenazi.
We're gay, so the rules are pretty much out the window.
No, I mean for you personally.
Oh yeah, I did. Again, it was funny. It was something that I happened to find a Jew. That's it. I am a big believer in your identity, your passion, your continuation of Judaism in your children. Doesn't have to be bound by marrying within the community, but preserving and passing on these traditions, that's just not up for discussion. You don't have to stay religious, but to cut off your children from stories, recipes, traditions, it's selfish because it puts a roadblock for then future generations that want to look back and find this connection to Eastern Europe or the Middle East or North Africa and just don't have these resources. Yeah. A perfect example of that is my husband, all of his cousins, none of them knew how to make kubbah. Obviously, kubbah is different variations across the Levant, but in Iraq, the Iraqi Jewish community typically do it. It's the semolina dumpling stuffed with beef and cooked in a sweet and sour beet broth. So it's a vibrant red and lemony and so absolutely incredible. His mother's generation doesn't even really make it either because the oldest aunts and grandmothers still make the kubbah for the family. And no one has anything written down. So I'm the one who went in, started making it with these aunts, followed them around with measuring cups and a scale, redid it at home, translated this recipe into something that's now preserved for his family forever. Yeah. And I want to do that with my family, with his family, with every family. I just think that is the mission.
Yeah.
So much of this recipe, there was this one step that his aunt was doing, which was rinsing the rice and then drying the rice before she ground it. And they're doing this based on just repetition because back in Iraq, like you had to, because there were stones, there were pebbles, there were twigs. You had to clean the rice. It was filthy.
Yeah, we don't get that anymore.
We don't need that anymore. And so that's hours cut off the recipe now because you can skip it. And there's so many instances of that, those things happening in which you get to start to think, great, now we're in America. We have these ingredients available. If you can't get this, like in the Middle East, like great, let's go in this route. And it changes it. I'm not saying that this is not changing the story, but that's Jewish food at its core, evolving recipes based on the movement of Jews. The only difference is that it used to be out of trauma, out of fleeing, out of war. And now it's out of joy. It's out of we move. We marry into different cultures. What I'm most excited about is this blending of Ashkenazi and Mizrahi and Sephardi traditions and recipes. Because too often we talk about this internalized separation between the communities. The idea of like, oh, you have to marry a Jew. For a lot of these communities, like if you're Persian Jewish, you have to marry a Persian Jew. Buhari, you have to marry a Buharian Jew. You have to marry another Ashkenazi. And I just think that that's so counterproductive to this idea of us and the unity of the Jewish people as a whole, which is really like celebrating the entire diaspora and all of our traditions, and they're all beautiful and they're all different and they all have their place. And I throw an incredible Ashkenazi Seder that like you can find great gefilte fish now in the States. You have to remember a lot of it was tied to the industrialization of the food complex. So as soon as people start jarring gefilte fish, it got kind of nasty, but you find some really boutique artisanal gefilte fish here in New York and it's delicious. And you have no issue paying God knows how much at a Michelin star restaurant for some kind of fish mousse.
This is what it is.
It's a parallel.
Yeah.
It's a parallel.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
But New York is amazing for Jewish delis, but also like Jewish delis in Philadelphia and Boston, like really good stuff, good food, good attention to detail. It's nice to see that. It's not really managed to infiltrate the UK yet, I don't think. But
you have great Israeli food. From personal experience, every time I go to London, I always end up in a great Israeli restaurant.
Yeah.
We got sick, we got a cold, and what did I want? Matzo ball soup. I wanted, and I had to get ramen because there was no matzo ball. Yeah. There was no chicken soup. Nothing.
Yeah. Itamar and I think we talk about it quite often. When we were kids, we remember this aspect of if you were a Sephardi Jew or Ashkenazi Jew, or, you know, you would stick to your kind of, it was quite racist when we were kids in a way between the, and now Israel is like, you know, it's kind of an open to all. So the food is mixed so much because everyone marries, like Itamar and I married, we're from quite a wide mix of traditions and most of our friends have all married kind of mixed. So everyone's eating everything and stuff like that. So the Israeli food has kind of evolved a lot where maybe if communities have stayed a bit secular, then the food hasn't evolved as much, but it's obviously starting to change now. Give me like some examples of things that you would say your husband has influenced in the book.
This book is a love story because if it wasn't for our relationship, we wouldn't have had this desire to explore Jewish identity. How do we build a Jewish household? What does that mean to us? What traditions do we want to maintain? He had never had babka. He never heard of babka before. He had never had gefilte fish, matzo ball soup. And likewise, I had never had tadik. I never had kugba. I never had gorma sabzi. I never had any of the things that he grew up eating for these same rituals. We're all celebrating the same rituals, just with a different menu. And I've been enamored by that. The way that charoset looks in my family versus my husband's, obviously Ashkenazi, apples, walnuts, manischewitz in America at least, and in Iraqi households it's just chopped walnuts and seelan and date syrup, and in Morocco they'll make them into truffles with dates. Like there's so many constants.
I love that you say that. I was kind of, what catches me through the book is you have your holiday menus, your Rosh Hashanah menus and your Hanukkah menus. Looking at it was like, oh, this is ours. This is, you know, this is new. This is different. This is familiar.
I think that there's definitely memories for anyone that's got any kind of Jewish connection in childhood, then the book will bring back things. But also, I think very approachable if you're not. So like I found, you know, you have this thing about kugel, and you try and explain kugel to anyone that isn't Jewish, really.
But my husband had never had kugel. He didn't understand it. He still doesn't really get it.
But you have to explain to people on the podcast, because quite a lot of listeners are not Jewish and won't know what kugel is. So explain, and then let's talk about variations after.
Yeah, kugel, it's a noodle pudding, a noodle casserole. It's a very dairy-heavy custard of typically cottage cheese and sour cream and eggs blended together and used as a binding for egg noodles. And the thing is traditionally in an Ashkenazi home, it's served at dinner, but it's sweet. So it's sweet and flavored with cinnamon and raisins, and it feels like dessert, but it's not. Which is why kids love it. But at the end of the day, that was the thing. My husband could not, and he still is not very big on mixing like sweet and savory, which is why I started making savory kugels, which is where like I veer from tradition, but I'm also thinking it's like, great, we're modernizing Jewish food. Like we're keeping this tradition of kugel and the power of cottage cheese and egg as a binder for almost like a baked mac and cheese. But instead of making a bechamel, you're just using kugel base.
For us, the kugel thing was the biggest argument when we, because I have the Ashkenazi idea where it comes with like cinnamon and raisins.
Yeah.
But for Itamar, look at his face, like, you know, for him, it's a Jerusalem style. Well, you can tell them, correct, Itamar, what a Jerusalem one. It's a completely different animal.
Completely different.
Yeah. So it's still kind of sweet, but actually not that sweet. It doesn't have eggs, I don't think, or dairy. I think you just cook it in oil and caramel and a lot of black pepper.
Loads of black pepper.
Kilos of black pepper. And you have it, you cook it overnight so it comes out really caramelized and brown. And you have it with pickles.
Which is strange.
But it's good. It's
Yeah. But I do think that in America, this food is so revered. Outside of Jewish community, you know, matzah ball soup is an American thing. Bagels are American. Babkas are American. I feel
bagels are everywhere, but here's the issue. The majority of people in America could not tell you that bagel is a Jewish food. They don't know the history of why we had to sell bagels, and they don't understand who brought them to America. There's this idea of New York has the best bagels because of the water. No. New York has the best bagels because we have the Jews that brought the bagels. So they're the ones that know how to bake it.
Don't they say that about the pizza as well?
The pizza. I mean, the pizza is very good. I will say we have the best pizza. But at the end of the day, that's also because you had the largest influx of Italian immigrants. So when we think about like, great, Jews then moved to L.A. Bagel shops open in L.A. Great, you can get delicious bagels in L.A. now. You can get it anywhere. However, in the majority of the country, you can only get mass-produced industrial food complex bagels.
Yeah.
Just gross. That's what people learn. Like, oh, that's what a bagel is.
A lot of food gets ruined by the mass production of food, doesn't it? You kind of lose the essence. But another big part of Jewish cooking is slow and long cooking, which kind of comes from this tradition of putting food on for a Sabbath and not having to cook then. So tell us a bit about kind of things that you would slow cook, how that kind of...
I'm looking to really push that entertaining, having people over for dinner, throwing a party, throwing a holiday. It shouldn't like make you want to pull your hair out. It shouldn't be that rough on you. It should be fun. The best foods are ones that you have to make in advance because they taste so much better later on. And it's not just Jewish food. Any culture that has long braises, it's always better the next day, 2 days. So my big argument is like, make a brisket. You get to make your brisket on Wednesday, pop it in the fridge, and then Friday you just throw it on the stovetop and reheat it. But then there's also those little things that you uncover, like the history of the slow cooker. And slow cookers were invented for cholent, for the Jewish community.
For Jews to...
like that's, and most people don't know these things. And once you understand them and understand why did they do that? Why did they have to do that? How has kosher law influenced so much of the way we cook or the way that we have tweaked different foods from around the world as we have had to move into new communities? Once you start to understand that, you start to understand like what makes Jewish food Jewish food.
What's it? What are you pointing at me?
I'm trying to not interrupt you. Itamar and I are trying this thing of not interrupting each other. We're very bad at it.
We tried it in 2019. It was hugely frustrating. I don't know if we want to do it again.
I want to talk about challah. If you can repeat to everyone, first of all, the symbolism and how easy it is, I suppose.
It is pretty easy. I think for most Jews, even if they're secular, if they've had any type of Jewish education as a child, the things that they remember the most are kind of the three prayers at Shabbat. And that's to light the candles, for the wine, and for the challah. And separate from the religious aspect, Shabbat itself is this incredible act of self-care in which you're separating one day from the other 6 days of work and grind and focusing on making the true kind of like idea behind it is 6 days of the week, you're focused on making the world a better place. And one day of the week, you're focused on resting and recharging. But these prayers are symbols of how you really designate this time for rest. So the candles are to ignite. It's this act of lighting the match is the last act of work that you do before you unplug. The wine is the symbol of the sanctification of the day, of your taking something mundane like grapes and turning it into something holy like wine. And challah, bread, is what makes it a meal, what creates the intention around the space you're building with family, friends, or strangers. I think that's an important part, is it's this conduit for bonding, for connection. So I have fallen in love with baking challah, which I actually didn't until lockdown. It was always a special occasion thing, but since lockdown, I've been pretty strict about baking it every Friday. And baking bread for someone is special. There is never going to be like a moment in which you sit down for dinner and someone's baked you bread from scratch and it's warm and fresh, that it's not special, that you can taste the love and care and attention that goes into it. It turns strangers into friends and friends into family. And that's the power of Shabbat. Anyone who's listening who's not Jewish, it's like Shabbat can be for you too. I think people forget that yoga was a Hindu practice that people just started doing because guess what? It's good for you. There's so many things that you can take from Judaism separate from the religious aspect. Just at its core are these incredible acts of self-care and or moral or ethical learnings that can help better yourself and your life and the way that you treat others. And I've been on this real path of encouraging everyone to learn how to bake challah.
It was a good time for it.
It's a good time.
Because in lockdown, everyone is baking bread. This is like being everyone's
so project. Much easier than sourdough. It's so, yeah.
It doesn't take you 36 hours to get a loaf of bread on the table.
Yeah, that's true.
And yours is a 6-blat, which is a little bit more elaborate than most. It looks amazing.
Most importantly, I'm a big believer in like, you do you. I'm not like, as long as you're baking challah, I don't care what you do with it. You can
not
like
many friends.
Roll, like my favorite is like, you roll it out and then you just coil it up into a round and bake that. Still delicious. Still a great plan.
I also think that people don't know how good challah is the day after and how many things you can do with it. French toast, challah is the only bread. Croutons.
The best is to soak it and then put it in meatballs, and it makes meatballs super fluffy as well.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's a good one. Ooh, I'm going to do, okay. Not to like for my next for my
now his head is sticking.
Yeah, now I think for my next book, I want to do a challah meatloaf.
You like, should. It's really good. The texture is super, super fluffy.
Yeah, it keeps it kind of set. I clocked the challah panzanella in your book, and I just know that it's going to soak those juices so well.
Yeah. Mm.
So we always say, you know, make two, make three, like make more. So Jake, you mentioned in passing the next book. Are you allowed to talk about it a little bit? Are you allowed to tell us a little bit about it?
The big thing that I'm very excited upon that I'm diving into is our bagels.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think that that's something that needs to be normalized as not only a Jewish food, but also that it's something that you can 100% make yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we're massive fans of bagels. So,
yeah. Yeah. Can I ask, the book has been so successful. Are you a celebrity now? Like when you leave the house, do people like, oh my God? Or
no.
Just in the Jewish community, or look at him blushing.
I don't know what to say.
Little bit.
It's funny because for the average person, they're like, who the hell is Jake Cohen? Everyone knows 15 Jake Cohens. But for a small subsect of millennial Jews are like, oh, Jay Cohen, I know who that is.
So you mentioned before giving platform and promoting Jewish voices. We have a little project. In the past, I think, 3 weeks, we've had a little bit of a discussion in the house, in our house, that we're trying to do the kosher version of OMG and trying to introduce Oh My Hashem as an expression.
Wow.
Do you like it?
Oh My Hashem.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Interesting is like the worst thing that you can say.
No,
you're either in love or you hate it.
Because I never say, oh my God, I always say OMG. Or no, actually, I never say OMG. I always say, oh my God. But I'm just thinking OMH.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think if there's another thing that people say that's like, there's like on my way. But no, I think OMH is, it's kosher. I think you could take it.
I think it's gonna creep into your speak, Jake, before too long. You're gonna be oh my Hashemming. I've been trying to fight it for 3 weeks, and then even I catch myself occasionally saying it, which is
oh my Hashem. I love that. I think that's a really fun one.
This is my, you know, you've done so much to promote Jewish causes, so many things that are good for Jews. I've done nothing, but this would be my thing. And I'm looking for ambassadors for this little.
I think you know what I think you need to do.
Tell me.
Merch. You got to have it on a T-shirt.
Oh my Hashem, that is so correct.
Yeah.
How do I not have it? How is it not a tote bag already?
You gotta get that. Gotta get that trademark before I come in.
Yeah. I don't want a trademark. I want every. It's an open source. I just want it out there.
Wow, what a mensch! Love it.
So funny. You guys are mad. You know, merch thing, this is a very American thing. You don't get a lot of merch is almost like embarrassing in the UK, whereas in the US everyone's like, merch is amazing.
Because we are capitalism. Like it's like that's it. It's like merch is an extension of that. And I think that there's something really so I'm doing all these recipe videos. A huge part of what I try to do is wear merch of brands, people, restaurants that I love. So I will wear like the Russ and Daughters, ex Jake Gyllenhaal have a few items out that they work together on that I wear. Or there's this young queer Jewish guy who has this company called Bobola, and it's like he has these tank tops for Pride that say Fagala on it, and I wore it and people go crazy. They're like, oh, I need that tank top. So to me, I think there's something really powerful about it in the state, at least. It's a sign of allegiance to a restaurant, brand, chef, person, that it's very unique. And it's strange. It's not strange. Because every person who gets any type of like, it's even on social media, everyone launches merch. And it's like, it has like their sayings on shirts or on hoodies or on hats. And I find it fascinating because people love to buy and wear it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you kind of fly the flag if you
fly
can.
Fly the flag.
Mm-hmm. I like that. And I want everyone to fly the flag for Oh My Hashem.
Oh My Hashem.
Jake, we just loved having this conversation with you. I am a little bit more forgiving towards Ashkenazi food than I was before. I will definitely try Kugel.
We're going to do a pop-up. I'm coming to London. Yeah, we're going to do a Jewish Honey & Co. pop-up, and it's going to be only Ashkenazi foods. We could have it with a lot of Middle Eastern, North African like ingredients, spices, influences, but the dishes themselves will be Ashkenazi.
We're going to have kind of harissa, chopped liver, and preserved lemon, chicken soup, all of these things.
100%.
Do you know what? I would so love for this to happen. I think we will have the best Shabbat ever, and people will love, you know, taking part of it. You know, you bring the light. It was just marvelous talking to you.
Yes. Such a pleasure. It's my favorite thing to do is just talk about
yabber on about food. That's also you know, a big Jewish pastime.
Such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Definitely next time in person in London.
He's hoping.
That is it for this episode of Honey & Co. The Food Sessions.
do join us for the rest of the autumn series. We'll be talking to chefs and writers from all over the world and from across food traditions too. We'll be talking to Copenhagen's Trina Henneman, to Seattle's Renee Erickson, and to London's Sami Tamimi and Tara Wigley.
Chetna McCann will bring us a taste of Mumbai via Kent. Caroline Eden journeys through Central Asia. And we'll end on something sweet, as always, with pastry chef extraordinaire Avnit Gill.
Thank you to our producer Miranda Hinckley, to our engineers Paul Brogdon and John Scott, to Daniel Winshall for writing the music, and thanks to Louisa Cornford, our Lulu, for all the help she puts into the podcast, and to all our team at Honey & Co. We couldn't do this without you.
Thank you for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.